But what we're going to do today is a book that came across my desk and I did the interview with, Mark Clark. And the book is entitled The Problem of God, Answering a Skeptic's Challenges to Christianity. Now, you are going to hear from him in just a minute because they're going to play the video of him. But here is an individual that grew up in an atheistic home with a kind of a worthless father, to put it mildly, go through a divorce, never had been into a church, I think, until the age of 19. So really grew up as a skeptic, grew up around skeptics, eventually becomes a Christian, interestingly enough, then becomes a pastor, and now he's a pastor of this mega church in Canada. Now, mega churches in Canada aren't quite like the United States, but still pretty significant because he is in Vancouver, British Columbia, and really from about Berkeley all the way to Vancouver. It's pretty pagan all the way up there, as you would know. And now he has other churches. I know he's getting one started in Toronto, and I think he has one in Edmonton, and these are all tied in just like our North Campus is. So he's really quite the dynamic individual, but he's really had a ministry to the skeptic and to the seeker. So let's for just a minute hear from him as he describes some of the issues he tries to describe, to answer, as he is not only writing this book, but also as he is the pastor of this church.
Has our study of science disproved the existence of God finally? We know that the universe began 15 billion years ago. Big Bang, all time, all energy, all space, all matter, in an instant. And everything came into existence. Hence, we don't need God. Is that true? I was raised in a staunch atheist house. Never went to Bible, never went to church. First time I went to church, I was 19. I thought the Bible was ancient and outdated. I thought there were so many hypocritical people claiming to be Christians. There's no way I could ever believe this. I thought there was this history of the church where they burned witches and did all these awful things.
So it's a new book out, and one of the things I like about this, I have been talking even with some of my staff members, is after a while you kind of hear the same things, whether it's Ravi Zacharias or William Lane Craig or Norm Geisler or Lee Strobel, and the last 2 weeks I've kind of given you some people that are just sort of coming at it from an entirely different point of view. So the book is 10 chapters, I'm going to look at 5, and we're going to move fairly quickly, because if you want to know more, obviously you can go to the book, but the first question he raised, and you saw that on the video, is the problem of science. And, you know, he says you can turn on a television and hear the host say, tonight we'll be talking about faith versus science. Our first guest is a former Oxford University professor, evolutionary biologist, and best-selling author who believes that science holds the answers. On the other side of the aisle, we have Joe Smith, who homeschools his kids, thinks Oprah is the Antichrist, and lives in a swamp. You ever been down that road? Yeah, of course you have, you know. First of all, you gotta love his sense of humor. As a matter of fact, a little bit later, we are going to talk about the heresy of Ricky Bobby, and I said when I interviewed interviewed him. The only guy I know that writes an intellectual book and quotes from Talladega Nights. So we'll get to that in just a minute. He's full of sense. But again, there's this dichotomy that we have in this world. You've heard us talk about this before, between the idea that I have faith over here and I have science over here. And the two should not meet. And it's really created by a culture that is just caught up in sound bites and extremes and the idea that you have to choose that. And then that's reemphasized by a lot of the so-called new atheists. Christopher Hitchens, when he was alive, talked about that. Of course, Richard Dawkins talks about it still in many of his books. And Sam Harris, the idea that faith is really evading evidence and irrationality is what it's all about. And so he takes on in one of the chapters there this myth about the fact that the various churches, especially the Roman Catholic Church, persecuted all of these scientists, because that's a story the atheists love to tell. Well, I'll just take one of these examples, and that is Galileo. You hear that he was tortured, he was thrown into prison, all the rest, and the bottom line is he was never charged with heresy. He was not placed in a dungeon or tortured. It is true that he was for a time actually placed on house arrest, but it wasn't certainly anything like what the atheists would have you believe. More than that, you know, there is an idea that the church believed in the flat earth. And again, he goes through some of the historical evidence that that was even known by the ancient Greeks. Pythagoras had a pretty good idea of the size of the earth, and people knew this. They would see these ships go off, and eventually they would go out of sight because of the curvature of the earth. We just had an eclipse. They could see the earth's pattern on the sun, on the moon itself. You know, they could see that that was a circular pattern. So there were lots of indications long before, and there is this kind of contemporary myth that everybody thought the world was flat until Christopher Columbus sailed to the New World. That's not true, and of course, it's just a good example of that as well. He also points out something that Dr. Norm Geisler and I wrote a book about years ago, and that is, it's not only not true that Christianity was at war with science, it is true that Christianity probably led to the rise of modern science. As he puts it there, the thing we presently call modern science was actually conceived and born, flourished in the matrix of Christian theism. You might say, why isn't science? Didn't science develop in other cultures? Well, if they believed in animism, that there was, you know, gods in these trees and in the ground and the moon and everything, well, they deified objects. So that really never led to the rise of modern science. Or polytheism, the fact that there are gods all over the place, then the answers were metaphysical, so they wouldn't try to use their minds to figure them out. Or even Buddhism, that the world is an illusion. So if anything, it isn't that faith and science were separate, it is that Christian faith led to the scientific discoveries that we have today, the whole idea of the scientific method. And in the book, again, I'm going to summarize a lot of this, but he quotes from an individual by the name of Kenneth Richard Samples, who's kind of a church historian and science historian. He's kind of looked at those interfaces and points out that there are 10 different reasons why Christianity led to modern science. I just give you five here. One is that the physical universe is an objective reality. In other words, what I see is not an illusion. It's really here, and I can really observe it. Number two, this belief in the laws of nature, that there is order, there is patterns, there's regularity, so then I can use my mind to investigate those, that the laws of the universe are uniform, that the laws of on Earth are the same as the laws in other parts of the universe, that humans have the ability to discover patterns, and even one more, in Genesis 1, 27 and 28, we're told out to go out and to subdue the world or to have dominion over the world. It actually, the scriptures actually encourage us to use our minds and to use our talents to make a better world. So again, if anything, there's not a dichotomy between faith and science, although there are individuals trying to drive a wedge there today, but if anything, those two come together very well. But then he also goes on to talk about something else, and that is everybody has some kind of faith. Even the scientists have said, well, I just look at rationality. Well, that's filtered through a grid or through a worldview. And sometimes, because of that, their worldview actually eliminates the possibility of God. One of the most leading evolutionists during the 1960s and 70s was a man by the name of Dr. Richard Lewontin, and he, in one of his essays, put it this way. He said that he and the scientific community have a prior commitment to materialism. That is, that belief that matter is all that there is. And so he said, we are forced by our a priori adherence to material causes, because he then goes on to say, because we cannot allow a divine foot in the door. We cannot allow the possibility that God might exist. And so what he says is what drives his science is not facts, but philosophy. So again, this is just, I think, a really good chapter to address some of those issues of science that sometimes are a real challenge for individuals. And I think it's not surprising that a significant number of college students come to his church. A significant number of millennials come to their church because they live in this world where they so believe that Christianity is anti-rational that when they actually meet somebody that's kind of intellectual, rational, and able to answer the questions, they want to just come and listen, if no other reason, to say, what does this Christian dummy have to say about this particular topic? So that's the first one. Second one is one that we did cover last week, but I thought it would be good again because he comes at it with an interesting perspective. And that is, what about the problem of God's existence? Because again, we live in this world that seems to suggest that God can not exist, or if God exists, he's irrelevant to your life. Well, Mark Clark starts by reminding us that in his book, Mere Christianity, the great Oxford Don, C.S. Lewis, said it was actually the argument of morality that was what caused him to begin to consider the existence of God. Because he noticed that people would oftentimes, when there was a problem, say things like, no, wait a minute, leave him alone, he's not doing anything wrong, or come on, you promised. And he said, you know, these people would make these statements, and he would make them as well, and it wasn't like they were appealing to, well, that's my preference, but they were sort of appealing to this moral law. Hey, you promised, you said you were, that's right, that's wrong, all sorts of things, because we are appealing to this kind of standard of morality that we expect other people to know about. Does the Bible speak to that? Yes, the Bible says that God has placed eternity in the hearts of every individual. That's in the book of Ecclesiastes. We go to the book of Romans, and it says that we see in God's creation and that they are without, what? An excuse. So he says that morality was one of the things that caused him to think about this. And today we live in this world where the skeptics say that our moral values, the things you think are right and wrong, are not objective, but they come from maybe our evolutionary development. In other words, they're just socially constructed and part of a culture. And so you can't really say that anything is right or anything is wrong. Well, interestingly, if Mark Clark, when he was in college, actually worked at Michael's Arts and Crafts Store. You know where that is, okay? And one of the people he was with, by that time he'd become a Christian, one of the people he was with was this kind of rank atheist. And so they got talking about morality one time while they were hanging up wreaths and putting prices on different things. And he said, you know, you say that there is no right or wrong, there's no good or evil, but let me ask you a question. Let's imagine you go to a very primitive area. We go into a village and they take your sister and they kill her and they eat her. Now, if you were really consistent, you'd have to say, well, what they did was not evil, was not wrong. It's just something that you don't like. But you'd have to, at this point, when you see somebody killing your sister and eating her, you'd have to say that that was evil, couldn't you? Well, his atheist friend sat there for a while and finally said, you know, even though I wouldn't like it, I guess I'd have to say the only thing I could say is it's something I personally disagree with. Well, you gotta love him being consistent, but nobody lives in that world, right? At this point, you recognize there's some kind of moral standard. There's some kind of right and wrong, and if there's a moral standard, there'd be what? A moral lawgiver. And so he, you know, uses that as an example of that. Atheists, though, sort of reject this idea that you need God to be good. And I hear this all the time. You know, as a matter of fact, I did a debate with an atheist a while back, and he said, you know, you Christians say, well, we have to believe in God to be good. But I know all sorts of good atheists and good humanists. And if you look at it, there was a study done at Harvard University a number of years ago, which is quoted quite often by atheists, where they found that was really no statistical difference between atheists and religious believers in making moral judgments. Which I think is kind of an indictment, nevertheless. But he brings us back to the fact that that's because I think all of us have some kind of sense of morality. John Calvin put it this way. There is no nation so lost to everything human that it does not keep within limits of some laws, some notions of justice and rectitude, as they could not otherwise distinguish between vice and virtue. You know, even when you meet criminals, I was reading about this the other day, this one criminal who's a burglar, even though he robs people and even though he breaks into houses, he's got a code of ethics about things he will do and things he will not do, even there. We were talking about the fact that even cannibals have this idea that, well, we have rules. We will only eat other members of other tribes, not our own. You know, I mean, even in the most perverted, twisted, values inverted kind of ways, people still have some kind of sense of morality. But we're not saying that you have to believe in God to be good, but if you're going to be consistent, that is certainly the case. Then finally raises the question about, if you look at this issue of cause and effect, nothing times nothing equals everything. You know, you saw him argue that in the video for just a minute. But we have what he calls the nothing hypothesis. What caused the Big Bang? Well, nothing. Well, how do we know it happens? Because we've got evidence of it. Well, how did it happen? Nothing. You know, he gets into this whole thing and he says, you know, nothing is what someone says to you when they want you to shut up, go back to sleep. You know, he talks about the fire alarm going off in their house. He goes around checking. Or I guess it was a burglar alarm, and checks it and everything, and so he says, I wonder what that was, and his wife says, nothing, just go back to sleep. You know, that's what you get from people that believe in nothing. But if you think about it, whatever begins to exist obviously has a cause. The universe began to exist, therefore what? The universe has a cause. Or we can look at it another way in terms of the evidence of design. Whether it's biology, we see that DNA is not random. It's an information code. And when we see an information code, we think that there was a code giver. And just the data in the DNA of an amoeba would fill 30 encyclopedias. Now, most of you are old enough to remember that. When I speak to a younger audience, I say encyclopedias, you'll see those in half-price books. You know, this is what we used to have before we had Wikipedia. They have never seen an encyclopedia. But Francis Collins of the National Institute of Health calls it what? The language of God. Or you can take astronomy. William Paley, we mentioned him last week. You know, he said that if you found a piece of wood, well, you would see that that it was something that was natural. But if you found a watch, you would see that that has design. And, of course, the Anthropic Principle points out that as we look at the universe, 122 different variables that have to be lined up for the universe to exist. So again, is it reasonable to believe God exists? Again, he would argue that. Three more real quickly. Chapter 3, he talks about this issue of the problem of the Bible. And this is a difficulty for our friends that are skeptics or seekers because they doubt that God exists simply because they wonder whether or not the Bible itself is legitimate. They have problems with its accuracy, its trustworthiness, even its truthfulness. And so he makes a distinction between general revelation, that would be like creation. In Romans 1, verses 19 and 20, especially Romans 1, 20, says, you know, that this creation shows God's invisible attributes so that they, that is the skeptics, are without excuse. But we're going to focus on the written accounts collected in the Bible, which would be special revelation. And it's kind of interesting because he points out that Christians sort of are very cavalier about their Bible. He tells a story from this novel. I don't know if you ever read the novel, but in the beginning, it's a story of this Jewish boy, and it's his recollections of growing up in a Jewish home. And he talks about, as a boy, that they, as Jews, the various rabbis and others, they would hold the Torah and they would dance with the Torah. And then eventually it came to him, and he's just a little guy, and the Torah, if you've ever seen it, is really big, and he's dancing with it afterwards. And after he finishes, and they go out, he's out looking out in the sky, and he's thinking, I wonder if Gentiles ever dance with their Bible. Because it was talking about how much the Orthodox Jews reveal God's Word, and we sort of take it for granted. But of course, we live in this world today that tells us that there are all sorts of mistakes, and one of those individuals who shows up on PBS a lot is Bart Ehrman. Well, one of his books is The Story Behind Who Changed the Bible and Why. And he looks at some of these possible contradictions in the Bible or copying mistakes. And so, just in the interest of time, he takes a couple of those, and I'll take the same ones. What about this issue of the death of Judas? Because in Matthew, it talks about the fact that Judas went out and hung himself, but in Acts, says that he actually burst open. And of course, we've discussed the fact that Judas probably hung himself and eventually decayed, or the rope broke and then broke out. And so you don't have a contradiction between the two of them. Or in Matthew, it talks about the angel speaking, but it talks about two angels, in Matthew. And in John, it talks about one angel speaking. Well, again, the existence of two angels does not invalidate one angel speaking. But I think they're also, or in this particular case, are talking about two different times when the angels were speaking to different women at the tomb. So the point I'm making is, and the point he was making is, when you look at some of these even so-called difficult contradictions, you can resolve them very, very quickly. But then he goes on to just remind us something we've talked about before, and that is when we look at the manuscript evidence, I had never really picked up on this one because we oftentimes use other examples. But he talks about, if you look at Aristotle's Poetics, these were dated, the first copies they have, and they have five of those. There's a 1,400-year gap for when Aristotle wrote those and the first copy that you have in your hands. These ancient biographies we have of Alexander the Great, and we have written whole books about Alexander the Great. We've done a movie about Alexander the Great recently. The earliest biography was written 400 years after the time of Alexander the Great. And yet, I hardly run into a historian that doubts any of that. By contrast, with the New Testament, we have 25,000 copies of the New Testament, and they were written during the life and times of the skeptics. They even mention the names of the individuals, in a sense saying, if you don't believe it, go ask him. 500 people saw the risen Christ at one time, and those kinds of things. And then one other point that he makes, and we picked up this a couple of weeks ago when we were listening to the video of Lee Strobel, is that the Bible has lots of what you might call counterproductive content, or we might put it another way, embarrassing content. Lee Strobel used the example of the fact that who are the first people to see the risen Christ? Women. And in that day, women were not considered to be a reliable witness. Well, Mark Clark uses some other examples. Supposedly, according to some of the skeptics, the New Testament was written so that the disciples could gain power and actually show Jesus in a favorable light. Well, first of all, Mark says they didn't do very well. They didn't gain any power at all. And they hardly show Jesus in a favorable light. Look at this. We see that Jesus is in the Garden of Gethsemane in what? Sweating blood. We see Jesus on the cross. What does he say at one point? My God, why hast thou forsaken me? Those would be what you might call counterproductive content. Or we can think of the disciples. We have Jesus telling Peter at one point that he is going to deny him three times, and Peter says, no, I will stand with you. And then what do we see? Peter denies Christ three times. Or you have the little battle with the mother of James and John, wanting to have James sit on one side and John sitting on the other side of Jesus, making them look pretty bad. I mean, we had all sorts of examples that, if anything, I think demonstrate the authenticity of the New Testament accounts. Two more. The problem of the Christ myth, he takes that on, and I thanked him for that, because if you might remember, if you've been in the class for a while, I took this on a couple weeks ago, because I'm starting to see that this is the new issue that people are starting to say. And that is that Jesus actually was a copy of other ancient myths. Mark Clark is in Canada, and he got to know one of his neighbors, and his neighbor said, you know, I appreciate that you're a pastor, but you know, you really are wasting your time, because Jesus is just a made-up person. Jesus is just a myth that was modeled after Horus, Dionysus, and other mythological gods. This is what he hears from one of his neighbors. Now, where is this coming from? Couple of different books. The Pagan Christ, written by Tom Harper, which has sold pretty well. The Jesus Mysteries, or of course another book that's just come out, The Christ Conspiracies. And what they argue is that the Jesus didn't even exist. He's a made-up individual, and he's patterned after all these other myths from the Egyptian or the Greek or the Babylonian stories of the time. Then you have the various movies that have come out, Zeitgeist, or Bill Maher's movie, Religulous, or a new one, The God Who Isn't There. And so these are the kinds of claims being made. So how do we respond? Well, the first one you see on the screen is, it's not taken seriously by actually legitimate scholars. I just quoted from Bart Ehrman a minute ago. Bart Ehrman believes there are myths. He believes that there are errors in the Bible. But Bart Ehrman, as a leading Bible scholar on the other side, I might say, he says this is ridiculous. But how do we respond to some of that? Well, here's what the argument of the Christ myth is. That when you look at Horus, or Mithras, or Dionysus, or Krishna, or other figures, they all kind of have a story that's similar to Jesus. They were born as a virgin on December 25th. They had 12 disciples. That there were 3 magi that visited the birthplace. That they have performed various miracles, like walking on water, feeding many people. They were crucified and they rose after 3 days. And so that's what you're seeing in these books. And if you're a student on a university campus and you have a late night discussion with some of the people in the dorms, you're going to hear that. So let me be Paul Harvey and tell you the rest of the story. First of all, let's take Horus. All right. Comes from Egypt. Was he born of a virgin? Actually, no. I don't know how you can come up with this idea. The mythological story was that he was created when Osiris, the god, had been chopped up, and they put the pieces together, and that was Horus. Was he born in a manger? No, he was not born in a manger. One of the books actually has the statement in it, but has no source to it. But some have said, well, Horus did have a visit from 3 magi. Well, actually, if you go to the story, it talks about him and the constellation Orion. We're going to do one of our Star Watch parties probably in the future. And in Orion, there are what? 3 stars. Yes, but that's not 3 magi. And then also, supposedly, he was a child teacher. You see that in one of the books, but again, no source is cited. And so, again, that's the best you can come up with, the Egyptian myth of Horus. What about the Greek myth of Mithras? Born of a virgin? No, actually not. Formed out of a rock and came to life with a dagger in one hand and a torch in the other. Well, that's not exactly the biblical story, is it? Okay, 12 disciples. Not actually. If you look at the Persian example of Mithras, he had 1 disciple. If you look at the Roman version, he had 2 disciples, but neither of them have 12. So whether you look at the Greek, Roman, Persian versions, they're all a little bit different. He was buried and rose again. Actually, there's no record of him ever dying, according to the myth. And I think the bigger issue for all of these is simply something I mentioned a few weeks ago when we covered this. Almost all of these stories, especially this one, Mithras, was written 200 years after the Gospels. So if anything, these were added later on to make it look a little bit like Jesus, not the opposite way. So again, that's the whole issue of the Christ myth. And then one more. more, because I know Parker's got some more things to share with you about the eclipse. And that is, I'm jumping now to one of the last chapters in the book, and that is the chapter dealing with the problem of exclusivity. Now, what do I mean by that? Well, it seems to me that what we run into right now in the world are various books that talk about inclusivity. In other words, that there are many ways in which we can be saved. And he says, if you walk into a Starbucks, you'll see people reading books by Deepak Chopra, Eckhart Tolle, Rhonda Byrne. These New Age books all include inclusivity, the idea that all religions have some part of the truth. Oprah Winfrey is a good example. One of the biggest mistakes humans make is to believe there's only one way. Actually, there are many diverse paths leading to God. So that comes from Oprah Winfrey. Okay, well, let's get into this in a little bit more detail. But one of the things he does, and I just had to include this clip, it's a short one here, but is the heresy of Ricky Bobby. Now, if you've ever watched the movie Talladega Lights, he is involved in a car crash and flips over. He has a concussion, and now he's convinced himself that he is on fire. And so at this point, we catch him where he has ripped off his fire retardant garment, and now he begins to call out to all the people that can help him so that he will not burn to death because of this fire. If you didn't catch all that, he first of all says, help me, Jesus, help me, Jewish God, help me, Allah, help me, Tom Cruise. I pulled out the one where he says, use your witchcraft to get the fire off me, help me, Oprah Winfrey. Okay, so he's trying to make sure he's checked every box, right? And that, if you will, is the heresy of exclusivity. And you gotta love Mark Clark, because if nothing else, how many times on a scholarly book do you quote from Ricky Bobby? But nevertheless, let's get into this a little bit more, because a lot of this has to do with this idea that, well, Christianity is just narrow-minded. It's really focused. It says there's only one way to God, and that's so exclusive. It's so intolerant. It's so bigoted. Mark Clark points out something that really most people haven't thought about, and that is Christianity is not alone in being exclusive in its truth. For example, if you look at Islam, it is perhaps the most exclusivist of all religions, because it believes there's only one God, Allah, and if you don't believe that, you are consigned to hell. It believes in heaven, it believes in hell, and in order to be saved, you have to follow the five pillars of Islam rigorously, including a pilgrimage to Mecca. That's pretty exclusive if you want to get right down to it. People say, well, yeah, but we need to have a really inclusivist religion like Buddhism. He points out that Buddhism is really also an exclusivist religion, because even though Buddha actually grew up around Hinduism, he rejects most of the ideas of Hinduism, keeps a few in terms of samsara and reincarnation, and even preaches, if you will, this whole idea of salvation, but he rejects the caste system, he rejects all sorts of ideas of Hinduism, and so what is oftentimes seen as an open-minded religion, Buddhism, is really pretty exclusivist as well. Or how about just kind of the American civil religion? I'm just going to treat everybody nice. You know, I'm just going to be a nice person, right? Well, again, be nice to everyone. But again, it tends to be what? Highly critical of what? Narrow-minded Christianity. So if you think about it, it isn't really all that inclusivist either. Almost every religious claim makes a claim that its view of truth is true, and oftentimes others are at least not accurate, if not false. And if you think about it, this brings us back kind of to the biblical claims. In John 14:6, what does Jesus say? I am the way and the truth and life. No one comes to the Father except through me. But then you see Peter, and I put this picture here. The picture there is of the temple steps leading up to the temple. Some of us that have been to Israel have actually sat there. I've actually preached on him. Well, this is where Peter is standing. He's right in front of the temple where people have come. There are millions of people that come there in Pentecost, and yet here he is saying there is salvation in no one else, for there is no other name under heaven given among men by which we must be saved. While he's standing in front of the temple that all the Jews believed was the actual way to salvation. So you think you can see pretty clearly that whether you look at what Jesus says or what Peter says or what Paul says, it is indeed making a claim that there is salvation in only one individual. If you think about it, also, religious inclusivism is kind of a logical impossibility because religions present different views on God, on who Jesus is, on salvation, and they are mutually exclusive. They are oftentimes contradictory of one another. And so as a result, if you really want to begin to think about this logically, this helps you understand that you can't have this idea that all religions basically are true. They can't possibly be that way. He tells the story of Tim Keller, who is at the church in New York City, and they had a gathering one time to talk about religious pluralism, and it had Tim Keller, a Jewish rabbi, and a Muslim imam. Sounds like a start of a joke, but it's not. No, it really was something. And what was so interesting is as they had the conversation going, eventually the Jewish rabbi and the Muslim imam said this: if Christians are right about Jesus being God, then Muslims and Jews have failed to love God as he really is. They went on to say, though, if Muslims and Jews are right that Jesus is not God, he's not the Son of God, then Christians' faith failed to love God as God really is. And what happened is a lot of the audience got upset because they want to believe in inclusivism. They want to believe that everything is true, but they came to realize, even in the conversation, that one of us probably has got to be wrong. Maybe two of us have got to be wrong, because it doesn't work for all of us to say that all of us believe the same thing. So what you oftentimes run into are people that try to say, well, maybe each religion has part of the truth, but not the whole truth. And you've heard of this before. Leslie Newbegin, who I'm going to quote from in just a minute, who was a missionary to India for 30 years, said that he would oftentimes hear people talk about the blind man and the elephant. That one blind man would feel the trunk and said, well, it's kind of like a tree limb. The other would feel the arms and the legs and say, well, it's kind of like a tree trunk. Another one was on the back of the elephant and said, well, he's kind of like a wall. Another one felt the ears and said he's kind of like a fan. Another one felt the tail, said he's kind of like a snake. And so as a result, he would hear this story oftentimes being told as he was a missionary for 30 years to India. But he says, you know, interestingly enough, the story backfires because it is told from the vantage point of someone who can actually see the entire elephant. And he goes on to say, it says it is immensely arrogant claim of one who sees the full truth all world's religions are only groping after. It embodies the claim to know the full reality, which he claims religions cannot in the first place. And so that's kind of the fallback position, that maybe each religion has a little bit of the truth, but only I have the full truth. And you think how arrogant that statement really is. Well, in the interest of time, let me come to a conclusion, because we certainly see that Jesus made very direct claims to deity. We have in John 10:30, he said, I and the Father are one. What was the response when he said that? The Jews picked up rocks because they wanted to stone him because he had committed blasphemy. We see, of course, before Abraham was born, I am, once again, blasphemy. And then I am the resurrection and the life. Jesus made some very direct claims. And so this idea that he was just a good moral man don't work very well. And you have then all sorts of indirect claims as well, because he claimed to forgive sins. You might say, well, I forgive people. No, these were sins committed against God. Only God could forgive sins committed against God. He allowed others to worship him. Imagine if somebody came up to you and got down on their knees and started worshiping you. You go, wait. I'm not deserving of that worship. Maybe a Hollywood actor would go along with that, but most everybody else would not go along with that kind of stuff, you know, and allow that. He also claimed to be God. He claimed to be the Messiah. And most importantly, he claimed to be what? The way to God. And so this issue of exclusivity is certainly a difficulty for individuals today. But Jesus once again reminds us that I am the way and the truth and the life. No one comes to the Father except through me. Pastor Graham told us today that we should be willing to go. Those first two words, the gospel, G-O. First two letters of God, G-O. We should be willing to go. And we need to go because the world needs to hear of the saving knowledge of Jesus Christ. So a quick summary of just a few of the chapters in the book, The Problem of God. Parker, let me turn it back over to you.